Welcome to the Way We Parent podcast, a podcast where we challenge the old paradigms of parenting and work on raising the next generation of rule breakers, because there is no way to be a perfect parent, but a million ways to be a good one. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Way We Parent podcast. This is Paula.
And this is Samantha. And today we have an interview for you with Dr. Tracy Baxley. She is a brilliant woman. She's behind the what do you call it, Paula, movement, the movement of social justice parenting. So on Instagram, she's at Social Justice Parenting. She's coming out with a book called Social Justice Parenting in October. It's on pre-order now. We talk about that in the show, and all of this information will be in the show notes for you guys too. She was fascinating to talk to, really.
Just so amazing. Lovely. Like, we've had the honor of interviewing some amazing people. And honestly, I feel so honored that she would even come on our podcast. I just want her to be my mom. She's just so sweet.
Yeah, she's so loving. Motherly. And yeah. Just compassionate. It just kind of like oozes out of her, which is always a cool thing to witness.
Yeah. With that, let's get into the episode and let's let you guys listen. Yep. I hope you love it as much as we did, because it was a really good conversation. So thanks so much, Tracy, for being here. We feel so honored that you decided to join us on our podcast. And we would love to start by telling the listeners a little bit about yourself, who you are and what brought you here.
Yes. Thank you, Paula and Samantha. It is my pleasure to be here. I love what you guys are doing. It's so the space needs you. So thank you for what you do. I am Tracy Baxley. Yeah, you're welcome. Mm-hmm. I am a mother of five, and I am also a educator, coach, and consultant. And my work all centers around belonging, this idea of having safe spaces for people to show up and be themselves, whether it's in the family, in educational spaces, or in corporate spaces. So I work a little bit all over. But mainly, you can find me at Social Justice Parenting. It's kind of the philosophy that I started a couple years ago. And it's really about, you know, raising children who will be change makers later on as they grow up, and what our roles are as parents, you know, to get them there.
That's amazing. Yeah. That makes my soul happy. Mm-hmm. The idea of raising kids who will change, are change makers and will, you know, push the status quo. I love that so much.
We talk about a lot as millennial parents on this podcast. We've said many times that we feel like the millennial generation are now coming into their being parents themselves and kind of flipping parenthood a little bit on its head. Like, we really like to do things differently. We talk about that all the time. How do we bridge the gap between what we're thinking and feeling and how what we want to do, you know, inside, and then what we're actually doing and the steps that we're taking?
Yeah. And that's the hard part, right? A part of the social justice parenting is this idea of moving outside of ourselves, right? Moving past some fear-based parent, which is my generation of parents live in, that we are, you know, we just want to protect our kids at whatever cost. And sometimes that costs them experiences, opportunities. Sometimes it squashes their natural curiosities. And we also project our own anxieties, our own fears onto our children. And so I think part of social justice parenting is being aware of that and being more intentional about the way we show up for parenting, so that we are not projecting all of those things onto our children. And I know one thing you just said that really resonated with me, Samantha, is this idea of being reflective. That's one of the core values that's part of social justice parenting, is that we have to reflect on the way we were raised and our own childhood experiences and the things we loved about our family life growing up and the things that we want to intentionally leave behind. And if we're not doing the work of being reflective on our own ways of thinking and our own ways of being, it's almost impossible to raise those children that we want to raise if we ourselves are not being conscious and intentional.
Exactly.
Oh yeah.
And that reflection can be painful. I mean, I think a lot of people get stuck there because it's like looking back and going, oh, my parents weren't perfect, or, you know, oh, am I acting like them? You know, there's so many layers to this to dive into. And I always say, we're not blaming that. I feel like, you know, there's no parent out there who didn't want to raise healthy children and be a loving parent and that they don't love and care for their children. It's just, we're given a set of skills and the time that we're raised in our own past history, and all these layers add into that parenting. So now it's okay to like reflect on that and go, okay, well, my parents' generation had this experience, and that's why they parented me that way. And they didn't have these skills that I have now. So I'm going to undo some of those layers and maybe try to change it a little bit.
Yeah. Let me tell you a great example of that. I use this example often because I think it's pretty ironic. Growing up, my father was raised or came of age during Jim Crow. So he had a real distrust of white people in general. I was raised, my family moved to an all white neighborhood when I was in fourth grade. And we were the only Black family in our neighborhood at that point. And he always had this thing of not trusting white people because it was his experience. And my brain had a hard time understanding that, because you moved me into this all white neighborhood. And as a 9-year old, how do I not trust all the friends that I'm trying to make?
It's a big cognitive dissonance for a child.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And my mom countered it a lot. And my dad wasn't like mean about it, but it was just his experience of staying guarded. And I mean, ironically, it's funny that I ended up marrying a white man, you know? So it was part of the reflecting to know that, you know, my dad didn't hate white people. Mm-hmm. His experience of being a young adult during Jim Crow really left him to be more guarded and wanting to protect me.
Mm-hmm. Understandably
so. Once I'm able to unpack that, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think that's like an example of me having to unpack a part of my childhood to know that it really wasn't what I thought it was as a 9-year-old, and that I make decisions based on my adult way of looking lens, and how I want to do things differently as I come of age.
Yeah. Right. I love that example, because I think it does exactly what I was thinking when I hear such social justice parenting, that term, I think of like zooming out a little bit. Right. And so there's that piece. There's that individual, you're like, maybe another man who grew up during Jim Crow wouldn't have felt that way towards white people. Like, who knows, right? So that was individual to him, but obviously that larger context is so crucial to understanding why he was the way he was and why he passed that on to you. And so I think that's the part we're often missing, because nowadays we hear a lot about inner child healing and reparenting, and we hear a lot about kind of going over our childhoods. But then there's the larger societal context. And I mean, yes. Samantha and I talk about that a lot, but it's like, you know, the fact that we're raised in a white supremacist society, in a patriarchy, and all of these things affect every single one of us. And I think sometimes that can get really scary for people. But yeah, I guess I'm wondering your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I think you're right on, Paula. Part of the way that we have to parent is looking at this from a larger contextual perspective, mm-hmm. Because we don't parent in isolation. I always say that parenting is activism, right? So the rules and the values that we create in our homes, they're going to show up in public one way or another. Mm-hmm. So if we don't look at it from a larger lens, we're doing a disservice, not just to our children, but to the society, humanity as a whole.
Right.
And so all of those things that we should be thinking about as we're parenting, that, and that goes to this idea of radical love that I always talk about, is this idea of thinking about the impact that my parenting on my children will have on somebody else's children. That includes this idea of engaging in open dialogue, being intentional about our parenting practices, having this transformational reflection that we're talking about now, which will lead us to, you know, positive action and potentially change.
Yeah, it's just like you said, I mean, it's this all spiderwebs out. I do feel like we're not parenting in a vacuum, just like you said. Like, this is not just your household and then it stays in your household and then it's never going to affect anybody else or your child's life after this. You know, it's like these things spiderweb out. And I do feel like a lot of people, and I'll be general here, I think that this is more like middle-class white people especially feel this way, that it's like they want to keep that kind of stuff out of the parent. It's like, oh, I, you know, I don't need to bring that stuff into my parenting. Like, we like everybody. We love every, we hear this all the time on social media. Yeah. Like, oh, you know, everybody is a person and that's how I feel. And they just don't want to take it any bit deeper because they see it as protecting their child. I think that's what I see it as, is like, they think, oh, childhood is just innocent. You know, there's no need to bring those things into childhood. Like, I just want to protect them, keep them safe. And, you're just kind of putting them in a false vacuum that will then release them into the world, is how I see that.
Yeah. And clearly that's not working, right? Look at our world. Yeah. No. And I call it bubble parenting, where they want to put them in this protective bubble, and keep them safe. But what you're doing is you're creating a child who can't cope when they go out into the real world, right? That they can't, problem solve. They can't, self-advocate. They can't advocate for others, by keeping them in this bubble. You're really squashing all of the potential that they can have to be leaders really in the world. And the flip side to that too, is some of us don't get that privilege, right?
That's what I was going to say. That bubbling, that is such a privilege to be able to do that.
100%. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
And then you see, I think that also breeds into, then you were raising another generation who, when confronted with these issues, they deny them, right? And I mean, that's been just mind-blowing.
They didn't see it in their childhood.
Right? They're like, racism isn't real. What are you talking about? Yeah. I love everybody. And it's like, wow, you live a different reality than other people. And I think we're creating that by ignoring that, by saying, oh, you know, they're too innocent and all of that.
Yes, absolutely. And we get more of the same.
Yeah. But that's the function of it, right? I think that's the way the system was created. It's let's keep that going.
Right. And that I taboo-ness of talking about race and gender issues or whatever the ism is, right? It becomes normalized. Mm-hmm. So it's just the way we are, is kind of the way we start to show up in the world. And if we don't start shaking that up and dismantling some of that, which your generation is doing so much better, we're going to always get the same things. We're always going to have people who feel marginalized, people who there's an inequity based on who you are or the group you're in. If we don't start to talk about it out loud, and not let our own childhoods or our own insecurities lead us in our parenting.
Yeah, for sure. Could I ask you to explain a little about equity versus equality? And I know this could be a really detailed discussion, but I do see those terms sometimes, and I had to research them myself not that long ago, because I was like, okay, we talk about everyone being equal, but I think really having the equity discussion and people understanding that is so important.
Yeah, I think if I put it into kind of mommy language, if you have a toddler and a four-year-old, and you give them the same kinds of foods, the same type of milk, the same expectations, right? That's equality. Everybody gets the same, and that doesn't work for everybody. So equity is about giving your toddler what he needs and giving your four-year-old what she needs. So it's not going to look the same, but yet everybody can become their best selves based on what is given.
That is such a good analogy.
Yeah, I got goosebumps. And then I was thinking about it in like healthcare, you know, we, if you believe like healthcare is a right, that we should all have health, which I do, then if you look at it that way, it's like, there's going to be person A who isn't going to need much from that, you know, and then there's person B who is born with type 1 diabetes or gets cancer or something, you know, it's like, they need a lot of that. Equal would be like, well, we're going to spend $5 on you and $5 on you regardless of, but equity would be, well, this person needs this and you might need it in the future. You don't right now. So you don't, you know, get that, but like this person does need it to survive and be healthy. Did I explain that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And I think people who have more power in society right now, there's a fear of losing the power. But there's so much to go around that we need to think about how we can share and make things more equitable for people who don't have any power, any voice that's being heard.
Yeah, I think that's a really, I love that you mentioned that. I think that that idea of that we do live in an abundant world. And I do think that that's sort of what people think. They're like, well, if, you know, the millionaires give up their power, then there's not enough to go around. But we see that, like, particularly in the United States, like wealth, you know, talking about wealth, because it's easy to quantify, you know, people like the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, the Jeff Bezos of the world, they have enough money to like considerably help a significant part of the population if they wanted to. And they,
I mean, you're talking about generations of their family won't use all the money that they have.
Right.
Yeah.
Like it's going to go too much
generation
money
to generation and stay in that family and, can, like not get used.
They continue to stockpile it. Right. Like you can think of like, I can think of like, it reminds me of Veruca Salt from like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. She just like has all the toys and all the things, you know.
Yes,
that's kind of how it is. And you're just like, no, but there's enough. Like, just share your doll with the kid that doesn't have a doll to play with.
Yeah, yeah.
And we hear, I mean, it's capitalism.
Chances are you won't miss it.
No, yeah, you won't. How could you at that level, you know? Right. But yeah, that's like the capitalist mindset. I think is like you have to step on someone else to get higher, and I just. It obviously doesn't have to work that way. I always tell people this, like, especially healthcare is kind of my thing because I'm a nurse. And so that's like always the hill I will die on for this because I saw it firsthand. I worked, you know, with very underserved populations, high drug use populations in the cardiac ICU and the NICU and saw it just all the time, like discharging homeless people to the street with like 3 days worth of medication, knowing like, I don't know where they're going to get it after that. Like it's horrible.
Yeah.
And I just always think like when people say, oh my gosh, you know, healthcare for everybody would be horrible. Like the services are horrible and everyone's unhealthy and there's no way to pay for it. And da, 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 da. And I'm like, you know, other countries are doing that, right? This is not like a new thing. And like, it's not working for us. I always, like you said, it's like, it's not working. We're protecting something that is not working for like the vast majority. And even part of it, I wonder too, is like, we do have the wool pulled over our eyes a bit for the people who maybe it could falsely seem like it's working for, like I could be in that, you know, we have health insurance, we have, we're middle class, stable, own a home, you know, it seems like the system is working for us, but if you dig a little bit deeper, it's actually not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also talk to, the parents that I work with, especially when I do workshops, about rethinking the idea of privilege. And I know lately it's been kind of hurled around as a weapon, you know, as something that's more divisive. And I think if we look at all of the identities that we hold, like I'm a Black woman who is Christian, upper middle class. So in all of those identities, cisgendered, right? There are some things that I'm privileged in and some areas that I'm marginalized in. And if I look at all the identities, instead of using those areas where I'm privileged as saying it's being offended because I have privilege in it or angry about it. Mm-hmm. I can say, how do I use this privilege as a tool for change? So it's not a weapon, it's a tool that we can use to make changes in the people who don't have privilege in that particular area. And so if you look at it, not as one way, because, you know, white privilege is the thing that everybody's afraid of, but that we have privileges in many areas and we may be marginalized in other areas. But how do we use it for tools for change instead of looking at it as something negative?
That's so important. Yeah. So what could you, I mean, I want to kind of bring this, because I think we've talked about this on this podcast a lot. We've talked about privilege and all of that. So I want to contextualize it for people a little bit. Like, could you give us an example of something that a parent could do, a white parent who lives in a white neighborhood and isn't exposed to people of other races? You know, what could they do to raise a child who's going to fight for equity? Does that make sense?
I think the first thing, which we already talked about, is this idea of reflection. So okay. Let's own it. Let's own what we think. Let's own how we feel. Let's own our own experiences and be honest with that. You know, do I hold certain stereotypes about groups of people? Do I have a bias? What are my reactions when I come across a group of people who look different from me? Think about why you made the decision to live where you live, to go to what school, and be honest about that. And be honest about the benefits of that, but also some of the drawbacks, what happens when you've done that. And then the other thing is, then I think we should think about how we diversify the things in our own homes or in our inner circle. Like I have my clients, if I'm in a workshop, to pull up their phones and look at who's in their inner circle on their phones. Like, do they all look like you? And the ones that don't look like you, where do you know them from? Is the person who cleans your house? Is the person who does your yard? Or do you have friends that don't look like you? So you need to be thinking about diversifying your own inner circles for your kids to see that diversity is important to you. So we can't tell our kids that diversity is important, but they're not seeing it in their lives in any ways. And also, you know, obviously the low-hanging fruit is their toys, their books and things like that, artwork, music, the things in your home that you can diversify. Those are things you can do immediately. So I would say doing an inner search is really the first step.
Yeah.
In creating more diversity in your own world. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that, looking at your inner circle and like, what are your kids seeing? Who do they see you interact with? In what ways? Like, those things really matter. That's the real life that they're imprinting. And then also, so for things like books, I love having diversity in our books. And we talk a lot about that and kind of, I've talked about like a book club that we're a part of, Little Feminist Book Club, that does a really great job with books that I just love them so much. But, what are your thoughts about this? So we are reading books with people who look completely different than us in the pages of the books. Is that where we stop with the book reading, or at a certain age, could we start saying, you know, in our society, racism is a real thing. Do you know what racism is? This is kind of how that looks in our world, and why we should, you know, do we like go deeper than just showing them the books?
Yeah, absolutely. You want to start off by highlighting differences, right, in the books. And then you also want to talk about how those differences show up in the world. Did you know that because his skin is brown or her skin is brown, sometimes people treat her differently? What do you think about that? How does that make you feel? This is what mommy feels. This is what we value in our own home. Mm-hmm. And so you want to start having those conversations. Another thing that's kind of teachable moments, I often see like at the grocery store or something, where kids are pointing out differences in people that they see. And the parents are like so embarrassed by that. And they kind of snatch on the kids and say, we don't do that. But what you're doing is you're squashing their natural curiosity, right? And you're making those things taboo. because those are adult taboo issues. They're not kid taboo issues. And so we have start rewiring how we respond to our kids when they notice differences, which is what they're supposed to do. That's developmentally appropriate for them. We respond to our kids. Yeah.
This came up a lot in the daycare because I worked in childcare before and worked in a predominantly white neighborhood. And but we had teachers that like our staff was very diverse, but the kids were mostly white. Anyways, and it would always come up in weird ways. You know, the kids would look at a teacher and be like, your skin is dirty or your skin looks, you know, we would use it as a teachable moment. But, you know, the parents would get mortified. There was one little girl, I think she looked at a book and was like, I don't like those people. And, you know, the parent was like so mortified, like, oh, my God, my child is racist. And it's like, no, you have a 3-year-old, like they're not racist. They're still figuring stuff out. And we need to use this as a teachable moment. But if you react that way, then they're already like, whoa, you know, let's stay off this topic.
Yeah. You've just taught them how to talk about race.
Right.
Yeah.
Or not. Or not talk about it.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And I wanted to bring that up because exactly you started that by saying you can point out the differences. It's okay. People are really, as adults, we're so afraid to do that. Like, you know, I think as a parent, we kind of are thinking that we should gloss over and just everybody's human and leave it at that. But like you said, the kid's natural curiosity, that's going to happen in childhood. And it should happen. And the way that our society works right now, we can't fix that. We can't change that unless we actually do talk about the differences. And I just love that because I want parents to feel empowered that like, no, you're not. I think we get this idea that like, if we teach them about this, they'll become that or something, or they're going to go out in public and start talking about racist people or like, I don't know. There's like a fear in talking about it.
And that's the whole thing, right? Moving past that fear to a place, what I call radical love. Like we really have to move beyond being afraid, because I can tell you this, you can talk about it or they're going to learn it from someone else. I mean, that's the bottom line. And you want control over, and control is probably not the right term, but you want to be the influence of how they see the world. Because media is there, social media, their friends, all that stuff is infiltrating. They are you know, how observant they are. They are seeing everything, all the nonverbals that you are putting out are the first things that they're picking up. And so you can decide whether your fear is going to keep you from teaching your children the things that are important to you, or you're going to allow the world to teach that to them. And I even making mistakes about it is fine. That's how we learn and grow. We're teaching our children that they can make mistakes too. But not saying anything, I think is probably the only wrong way to do it.
Yeah. That idea of letting our kids know that we can make mistakes, I think, that is so new. I feel like, I mean, my parents' generation didn't do that. You know, they didn't, they were perfect. Yeah. Like you know, and I'm sure you probably feel the same way. It's only now that we're starting to normalize apologizing to children and, you know, admitting our flaws. And I love that so much because I think it is so crucial, because how many of us grew up thinking our parents were perfect, and suddenly at some point when you were a teenager or a young adult, your whole world crumbled when you realized that they weren't.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, like when I became a mom, I was intimidated because I thought my mom was such a perfect mom. And when things were hard for me, I was thinking, how did she do that? You know, and we've had conversations later and she's like, I did not do it perfectly, you know, and I look back and I had a really wonderful childhood. But it was not until I became a mom that I realized there's no way she could have been perfect. This thing is hard. Mm-hmm. And so my husband and I started talking with our kids as early as I can remember. One example I have, we had a neighbor who came to our house, my daughter's friend, and we had already talked to my kids about sex and where babies came from and all that stuff. And my daughter must have told the neighbor, the neighbor's kid. And my neighbor said, well, guess where my daughter found out about sex? And I'm like, oh God, I know it's my daughter. So then we had to tell our kids, you know, this is the way we choose to have conversations in our homes. Every parent's not that way. And so you can't go telling your friends what we talk about in our house, because their parents want to be the one to tell them how things work in the world. But we've always had this open dialogue about either not knowing the answers, let's find it out together, or I made a mistake, that's not right, let's refix this, or apologizing when we've done something that has offended or disrupted our kids in some ways. And I think we raise kids who are able to do that in the world.
That's amazing. How old are your kiddos now?
They range from 21 to 11.
Wow.
So one daughter who just turned 21, and then four boys.
Wow. It must be so interesting, like, I guess, to see the fruits of your labor as you have kids becoming young adults.
Yeah. And you realize that you can survive anything, right? You really, things feel so daunting at the time when things are going on in your world. But you realize when you're on the kind of the back end a little bit, you get to see that all of those things that were going on were part of the journey. You know, I have a child with ADHD. I have a child with OCD, high anxiety, and I have another child who battles depression. And those are things I had to learn as a mom, how to mother that, you know, a lot of research, a lot of crying, a lot of adjusting. But we found our way. And, you know, I always say, you know, not parenting the kids that we thought we would have, but parenting the kids that you actually have. And some of that will be a learning journey for us as mothers, journeys that we didn't know we had to go on.
Oh, I love that. I always say to people, like, parent the child in front of you.
Absolutely.
That can mean so many different things. I have a question for you that's a bit more of a personal or selfish question on my end, because my son is biracial as well. And so I'm always curious to know, like, I guess I'm curious to know if you have any insights for someone like me trying to raise a biracial son in this world. I feel like there's an added layer of complexity when, you know, he's at the intersection of two identities. And I know that, you know, interestingly enough, a lot of the people who follow me fall into that same range, because I think people tend to look for people who are like them. So yeah, I'm curious to know if you have any wisdom.
Yeah, I probably have a lot of wisdom on that with my five kids.
Yeah.
I think one thing that we did was we let our kids self-identify however they felt comfortable. Right. So I have my daughter who is a Black woman. My oldest son, he identifies as being biracial. So I let them, give them the freedom and the safe space to identify themselves.
Love that.
But I also raise them to be Black human beings in the world. And what that means, all the joy that comes with that, but all the limitations that come based on societal views. So making sure that they're able to navigate in the world as Black, but embracing who they are as human beings, and all that comes with being biracial.
Right.
But I also find that it goes back to what you just said, Paula, about parenting the kid who's in front of you. My kids are all very different in the way they found their who they were. Some were very rocky. The road was tougher for my daughter than it was, you know, right now for my oldest son. And so I think being very intentional and individualized and helping them to find their identity is really important.
Right.
I think it's really important to make sure that they are connected to their Black selves, because that's going to help them to navigate in the world a lot better, knowing that and learning that at home.
Yeah.
Because I know some parents who have biracial kids who were upper middle class and everything they did with their kid was white based. And then when their kid got in the real world and realized that the world saw them as not white, it was very devastating for them to make those adjustments.
And that's, I think my concern is, like, I don't want him to feel isolated by any group. And I feel like he probably will be, but you know, it's just that, like, complexity of,
I think finding different spaces with different kinds of people is really important. Like, they need to have a space where there are Black people.
Yeah. And that's a complexity that I think that's a whole other layer of privilege that we can talk about, because, you know, right now my husband and I are looking to buy a home, and it's, I've talked about this on the podcast before, but Toronto is insanely expensive. So we're moving to, like, a small town, and that's a concern that I've had, and, like, trying to do research, and it's like, you can't really, like, go online and be like, how many Black people live in this town? You know, you can't really do that, but I'm asking, like, what's the diversity like in this place? Because my fear is to end up in, like, this super white town where my son is not going to school with anybody who looks like him, or who looks different in any way. And he feels, you know, isolated. And so that's really important for us to when we're looking to move, where it's something that another family probably doesn't have to think about.
Yeah, definitely. And your world has changed for sure. You know, seeing different life from a different perspective, I think probably after marrying your husband, but I think also going to the schools and asking what the percentage of diversity is in the school will give you an idea of the neighborhood as well. Yeah.
That's good to know.
Mm-hmm. But yeah,
and I just want to point out that you all, both of you are talking about things like, you are going to talk about race, skin color, and racism with your children because you have to. I mean, this isn't something that, like, you know, my family, we're all white. If I wanted to not talk about it, I could not talk about it. And we live in a primarily white area. And I just want to point that out for people listening, because I think the fact that there are some people in this country who absolutely, for the safety of their children, have to talk about race and racism with their kids, and then there's another group that could go forever and not mention it, that it should tell you all we need to know. Like, we all have to talk about it.
Yeah. And if the people who don't need to talk about it are not talking about it, then we're not, nothing's going to change.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to continue on to the next, you know, and then it's the same way with the next generation. And yeah, that just, I think, is so imperative for people to know, like, yes, talk about it. You know, if one group of people in our country have to talk about it for safety, or not just in our country, in our world, really, but if one group of people have to talk about it for the safety of their children, then we all have to talk about it for the safety of everyone. Like, this is, you know, just so, I mean, I've always thought, oh yes, I'm going to talk about this with my daughter openly. I'm not just going to, like, I do want to show her diversity, but I also want to talk about these things. And now I'm kind of thinking, she's 2 years old, and I'm like, how can I start this now? She has, like, diverse books and all these things, but, like, I really, you know, we have to take that step, and it's going to be uncomfortable for us if you've not had that in your life, you know, previously. And that discomfort is how, you know, getting through that discomfort and kind of, like, pushing past that is really essential.
Yeah, it is. And I always say to you, if you are in the middle of, like, anti-racist work, if you start to get comfortable, then it means you're not pushing yourself enough. So it's okay to be uncomfortable, because it means that you're doing some work. And I think the biggest takeaway is that you keep doing work, no matter how small it is. Activism looks different for different people. You find the way to be an activist the way that makes sense for you and your family, but that you keep moving, you're taking steps, and you're being active in what you're doing and how you're raising your children.
Yeah.
I think not discounting how just what you do in your home can be so transformative, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. That is where I think we can make the most changes. If we can start creating this tidal wave of change in our homes, mm-hmm. It will change everything else. I think it's really the only way that we can change systemic racism is by starting right. in our homes. That's right. Why the work that I do with families is the most important work, because we're raising those children to go into the business world, to go into law enforcement, whatever it is, to be different and to see the humanity in the person that they're looking at.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I think that I love that. I think the movement is starting to, and when it comes to parenting, is about also seeing the humanity in your own child. So, you know, even like, say, like, you don't even talk about race, but like, the accepting your child for who they are, allowing them to express their emotions, all of the things you mentioned that you do with your children. I think if we don't give that to them, how on earth are they going to see the humanity in other people, right?
Yes. I always say that we need to create spaces of belonging in our home so that we're raising kids who are creating belonging in the world.
Oh, mm-hmm. Love yeah. that.
That is, it's empowering. I always use the word empowering and kind of like define it for people as like, no one can give you power. But like that comes from within, but we do create systems in which we're like oppressing people's power, and power looks like a lot of things. And I think the very first, like in childhood as parents, the very first power that we give our kids is like kind of coaching them into like self-esteem and self-worth. And all those really important things that were all emotional maturity and empathy and things like that. That's like empowering them to go about the world and feel like they can make a difference. Like what they're doing, it can make a difference, that it's worth pushing for this change, that, you know, I just think that's so important. Like for those of us who feel like, oh, childhood is this safe little bubble and I just want to keep them in that and they're so innocent. Like you said, they're going to learn it somewhere. They're going to learn it. I mean, at some point they're going to learn about this and they're going to see it firsthand. They're going to see it happening in their life. And how do you want them to see that? Do you want them to see it as like, it's just the way things are, or like not really notice things so much, like that it matters what we're doing with that?
Yeah. And to make the change, we all have to do it together. Like, yeah, we really are stronger together.
Oh, that's, I wanted to ask you about your book. Yes. So you have a book releasing this year, which is very exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. Very excited about it.
Yeah. So it's Social Justice Parenting, right?
Yes.
And what can people expect from your book?
Yeah, it's called Social Justice Parenting. And the subtitle is How to Raise Compassionate, Anti-Racist, Justice-Minded Kids in an Unjust World. So it's a little wordy.
I love it.
But it's in the book, we talk a lot about the five building blocks of social justice parenting, which the rocks, I call them, right? Reflection, open dialogue, compassion, kindness, and social justice engagement. So we do a lot on those things. And the book is very practical and relatable, and it's an easy read. And there's a lot of personal stories and lessons that I've learned as a parent, both good and bad. And then I also have other parent stories in there around these things. But we also have chapters on anti-racist parenting, belonging, this idea of creating safe spaces and core values for our homes. Teaching self-advocacy is a chapter. And then there's a resource of like 100 books that you can use in having dialogue with your children around these, what I call the rocks, like, you know, so at different ages, I have books for different ages around these big topics that you can use as tools to start the dialogue.
That's amazing. That's going to be such a good resource. I can't wait to read that. I hope everybody goes out to get that. I think what I have found being learning more about social justice and kind of bringing it into my world is that sometimes it feels like it's not translating to like, but what do I do with my young child? You know? I feel like, yeah, that bridge, that is amazing. That's going to be a great resource.
Yeah. That was the point of trying to say, okay, we're all talking about it, but then we parents are like, okay, so now what? Mm-hmm. I tried to put in things that like conversation starters that you can have with your children, how to talk about, you know, why skin color is different. Those kinds of things are part of the book so that it's kind of an added thing to your toolbox of relatable conversations and topics that you could use when trying to open up this dialogue with your children.
Yes. Putting out a book, and especially one with all those resources and just the work. So congratulations. That's amazing.
That's super amazing. Is there any other resources that you would recommend to families or anything that you have online or anything else that they can find you?
Yeah, I have some articles on PBS Kids and Sesame Street, right? Sesame Street just opened up their a whole program around diversity and equity. So I have a couple articles with them and like a flashcard kind of activity that I did with them. So it's a great practical things, again, to get you started. I also have a course on, you know, mostly for white moms who want to be allies to teach your kids and talk about racism. That's a kind of an evergreen course that I have on my website.
Amazing.
And also I have started a social justice parenting program, which is a 6-month program with me where we do, some of it is self-directed and then we do live Q&As.
That's amazing.
And so I'm in the middle of one of them now, which has been great. We have moms and dads. I'm a part of this. There's like 20 families. So that's great. So the next one of those will open up either August or September. So I'm going to do it twice a year. So the book will be an addition to that once the book comes out in October. So that's been really great with working with families directly. I was going to say my Instagram is, you know, obviously a lot of free resources that I put up my thoughts based on questions that I get from parents and things that are going on in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed recently you posted about some hate mail that you got.
My first hate mail.
Was that your first? So like first like email.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting thing about social media. We talk about this a lot, the world that we live in, because it's can be really draining and exhausting. But at the same time, I almost think it's good that we are interacting with those people that I think maybe perhaps you would have never interacted with someone like that before. Not that it's okay for them to do that and to say those things to you, but we're seeing it more. We're spreading the word more. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense because I didn't take it personally. Mm-hmm. What I did was it reminded me that I have to keep doing the work that I'm doing. It was like a call for me to say, keep moving, you know, keep doing. So it fueled me. I didn't mind it.
I think that's important because we don't want to get discouraged in this. I mean, it could be easy to, and I'm saying that as a white person, and I don't even want to say I could feel discouraged because that's not, it feels unfair for me to say that, but it's true. Like sometimes things can feel discouraging, but it's not discouraging. We are making progress and we have to let that fuel us of like, that's why we have these tough conversations, why we care about this and why we're going to push through and learn more and do more. And like you said, it's fuel, let it fuel you.
Yeah. And then sometimes because I'm also an empath, so that these things kind of pile up and build up in me. And like, sometimes I get physically sick when things happen in the world, but I've learned how to give myself the break that I need, give myself a little bit of grace. And I used to not be able to do that. I used to be very hard on myself. Like, how are you think you need a break when these people are dying or another mom has lost her son? Like, you don't get to get a break. Mm-hmm. But I've learned that when I tell other parents that I'm working with, my clients, to give themselves grace, that I need to apply that to myself. And so I would take a break for as long as I need to replenish. And I've gotten to where I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm. That's so important because you're worthy of taking care of your emotional, your mental, and your physical health. We all are worthy of that. And there's going to be periods where that looks differently. And then there's going to be periods where it takes a lot more to take care of yourself in those ways. But we all have to do that. We can't do that kind of work without it.
Definitely. And yes.
That's revolutionary in itself, right? Like just
the
fact that you can give that to yourself and not feel guilty. I think that is so crucial. Letting go of that guilt. And because I think we've, again, a function of capitalism and a function of white supremacy is that we have to go, 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 right? Stay on the rat wheel and just keep going. Keep making, you know, keep making money, keep bringing to the economy, keep whatever.
Especially as moms, right? We wear so many hats. And we want to do it with grace, but we want to not feel like we have to burden other people that we just keep taking it on. But I've learned, that support is needed and people want to support you.
Mm.
And I always tell my kids about giving joy and receiving joy, because when you allow people to help you, you've now made their light shine. And so being open to allowing somebody else's light to shine is also as important.
Oh, that's such a, like that just kind of blew my mind a little bit. That's such an amazing concept.
We
think about it so selfishly, right? Like, I can't let people help me. I'm taking advantage of them. But what if letting someone help me is actually helping them?
Yes, exactly.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. We talked about with another podcast guest, the village that everyone talks about, how you had to raise kids. We need a village. And I was saying, like, I always felt like, is there a number to call in the village? Like, where do I get a village? Because like my family doesn't live close to me. They all live far away. And like, how do I get that? And then in talking to them and then hearing what you just said, it's like, yeah, there are people willing to help and support you. And also we got to be willing to do it for ourselves and for other people too, of course, but yeah, there's totally people willing to help. And when I started thinking about it and like thinking about the people in my life that are around my daughter that would help, but I'm the kind of person that's like, I'm going to do everything myself. And I really think that modern motherhood expectations really don't help with that if you already have that kind of personality. But it makes it seem like you are the head of your household, of your life, of your children's lives, of everything. You should be in control of it all. You know, we have to do all the things. We have to work and parent our children and have a clean house. Like, it's all the things.
Yeah. And what I tell people to do is to look in the mirror when they're doing that and think about what they're teaching their children.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you're modeling for them something that's not healthy and you don't want to pass that down to them. And so show up for yourself in a way that you want your kids to show up for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Man, it's like everything. If we just kind of think about our children in different contexts, like they really help to reframe everything for us, right? That's when you just said about having people help you, that I just thought about my toddler and how he wants to help, like with things around the house, and you know how sometimes letting him help is more work. But it makes him feel special. And I guess, you know, it's the same with adults. And like, if I offer to help someone, you know, it makes me feel good too. And you want them to say, to appreciate that. Right. So it just really made me think of him. So yeah, I just think it's amazing how our children can really reframe everything for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those are the kind of kids you want in the world. Those kids who learn to be kind, who build that habit of kindness and build the habit of compassion in their homes, because that's what they're going to spread out into the world.
Yeah.
I know my daughter, and I put this in the book, as she, you know, she was our first. So we poured into her the lessons in this and the lessons in this. And this team and that thing. And when she became a young adult, reflecting back, you know, I'm the queen of belonging, you know, this is who I am and what I do. And she said, you know, I felt like I wasn't good enough. Like, you guys had me in so many things that I felt like I had to be perfect. And part of that is part of her depression. And to think that I had a piece of that and not causing the depression, but definitely her reflection on, I felt like I always had to be good at all of the things, mm-hmm. instead of us introducing these things, thinking we were giving her opportunities. And so me, that was something hard for me to have to swallow as a mom who prides herself in providing safe spaces for my kids, that my daughter felt like it was all too much and she didn't know how to tell us. And so I, you know, I write about that moment as a mom that we have to then rethink about how we did things and where we may have made mistakes and how we would do things differently. And not in terms of having mom guilt, but in being able to release it and then having those dialogues with our kids about what we may have done differently and how we support where we are right now.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And that is a beautiful gift that you gave her, though, as a young adult, that she could go to you and tell you those things. And then, you know, you move forward and like, you're there to support her and help her as a young adult too. And I think as parents, a lot of times, like we don't want to have that reflection piece of like, but my intentions were good. Obviously your intentions were good with what you were doing. And it's like, yes, that's true. And also sometimes we miss the mark of what we were, our goal, your goal was to have your daughter be, you know, learn all these things and be really involved and active and feel like, you know, she's having fun and she's involved in her community or make friends or whatever. And like, maybe we miss the mark sometimes on the goal, like, you know, the end result. And that's okay. I think being able to go like, nobody's perfect. And, you know, we all know our parents weren't perfect now. And we have to be able to work through those tough feelings.
Yes. And it really is, like you said, it's the gift to her to be able to me and me to say, yeah, okay, so how do I support you moving forward?
Yep.
Yeah, I just love that so much. And that self-awareness for you to, and the vulnerability for you to be able to accept that. And, you know, I think bringing it to kind of what Samantha and I do, because we work with parents in their very early journey. I talk about sleep training, and that's one of the things I get all the time is people saying, well, you know, you're shaming me because I chose to do Cry It Out or whatever. And, you know, and Samantha gets similar stuff. And I just, one thing I've always kind of, that bothers me is how quickly we are, how quickly we turn to, I'm uncomfortable. You're making me feel shamed. You're making me feel guilty. Shut it down. Right.
Yeah.
And what my thought is like, okay, but while as adults, we're feeling uncomfortable, who's taking care of the children? Like who is thinking about their well-being? So if we never talk about things that we think could be harmful or could be not in our children's best interest because it makes people uncomfortable, well, then how are we ever going to do right by our children, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and learn and grow.
Exactly, right. So, yeah, and I mean, this is with little things, sorry, like little things. And it's interesting because like I have, you know, I think parents tend to
catastrophize.
Thank you. Catastrophize. Right? Yeah. Little things. And they'll be like, oh my goodness, I, you know, thought it was bad to nurse to sleep and I stopped that. And now my kid is ruined. And I'm like, no, your kid's not ruined. But you've learned something that you want to change. But yeah, so, and then you're dealing with that on a much grander scale with older children. But I think it's still a muscle that we need to practice from the very beginning to be able to let go of the things that we maybe didn't do as that didn't fit our values and be able to kind of change course.
And, right. And know that you can always pivot. You can always pivot. Mm-hmm. You know, you're trying something out. It's not working for you or your child. Pivot. Mm-hmm. Nothing is set in stone. You can always make the adjustments. You can always make the changes. The more you learn, the more you grow, the more you interact with your child, allowing your children to tell you what they like and what they don't like, and being open to that. You can always pivot.
Yeah. When it comes to being an anti-racist parent, doing that as a white person, I think there is that element of like, when we're hearing about our racist society or white supremacist society, there is an element of shame. Like, oh, that can't be true. That feels pretty shameful. That must be, that's bad. That's reflecting badly on me as a white person. And I feel shame about that. And so, like you said, Paula, the kind of instinct that we go to often is like, so shut that down. That can't possibly be happening or be true because, you know, I'm not a bad person and I can't confront that. And it's on a, that is like a huge scale of what we're talking about, but it still goes down to like what we do in our home with our kid. Because to say as a white person to your white child, like, look at what we're doing as white people, like this is the system that we live in, and to change it, we need to talk about it. Like, there is an element of shame to mm-hmm. that. And that's not bad. Shame teaches us things. Like, that is an internal process yeah. that is a cue to us to go, okay, so I want to change this then. Like, something is making me feel very bad. And that is a cue to me that I need to go deeper with it.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that kind of leans into Brené Brown's work with shame mm-hmm. and vulnerability and courage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it takes all of those things, right, to grow into your parenting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. I love Brené Brown's stuff. And yeah, I think shame requires me caring. Too. And that's ultimately, like, you wouldn't feel ashamed if you didn't care.
Yeah.
Right. Mm. And so I think maybe we should give ourselves more credit in that regard.
Yeah.
That we just
it's care. Not something to be squashed. It's something to learn from and act on.
To lean into. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think about how, and I'm curious of your thoughts on this, like how our young, like the youngest children tend to be so carefree. And I wonder if it's because we've learned all our lessons as parents with our first few. Do you find that it's a huge difference between your first and your last?
Listen, there is definitely something to that. There is definitely something to that. Mm-hmm.
It makes me so nervous because maybe my daughter will be an only child. We don't know if we want to have more children, but you know, I'm a pretty like type A, some may say controlling kind of person. And I worry about that. I worry exactly what you said about your daughter, your first child. Like that is, I worry that I'm going to do that to my child or I'm already doing it. And like, sometimes I'm like, I need to have more kids just so I'm forced to lighten up. Yeah.
But the fact that you're aware of that is the first step, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so you just take small steps to try to, and you know, being aware when it's happening and again, mm-hmm. pivoting. And taking those small steps to make big changes. Mm-hmm. Mine started with the towels, right?
That's
didn't
so good.
Giving up how, if I wanted my kids to help, the towels in the cabinet, I mean, in the pantry, not the pantry, whatever it is, they were not going to be folded right.
Oh,
so
yeah.
How do I be okay with messed up folded towels?
Right.
But allowing them to be a little bit more independent. And so mm-hmm. those are the kind of things that I gave up early. Mm-hmm. And now I'm just like, you know, if you want to live out of those wrinkled clothes in your basket, that's on you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's times where we move through in all things of parenting and there's just kind of like our snap reaction to like how we handle things, which is just what we've learned and kind of the skill set that we have. But then I try to tell myself this, like, it may seem like there's not another way to parent or be in this specific situation, but I'm just going to meditate on that a little bit and think, see if I can come up with some other ways I could handle this, you know? And most of the time I do, like my toddler starting to throw big tantrums was a huge mental block for me because the only reaction that I learned was like anger to be, mm-hmm. You know, yell like what I don't like what she's doing. And so I should be angry. That's like really all that I had as like a skill. And when I started thinking through, like, okay, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be angry with her. Like, I don't want to react out of anger. So what else is there? And at first I was like, I literally don't know. And I just felt stuck. And then I just had to like really sit with that and think through like, how do other people react, good and bad? Like, what do I see? What do I hear about? What do I learn? And now I have like a process I go through when she has a tantrum. I'm not perfect. I still get mad sometimes, but I have a process now. And I think we could do that with like a lot of things in parenting.
Yeah, I agree. It's like you say, we're filling our toolbox with more tools that we can use as a parent. Mm-hmm. And the more tools we have, we can pull them out at different situations. And that's how I see social justice parenting. It's a tool. It's a tool to put in your toolbox for how to navigate in the space. Maybe you won't use it every day. Maybe you'll have it in there and not use it till next year. But the more tools that we can add to our parenting, I think the more successful we can be at pulling different things out for different kids in different situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to like bring it kind of full circle, when you talk about belonging, I think doing those things, having that tool in your toolbox, creates belonging for when your kid goes out into the world and is interacting with other people, and then they're able to do that and make change. And then also within themselves, like we're kind of demonstrating the worth of other people and our child and giving them that sense of belonging too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I see it three different levels, creating this idea of belonging, compassion, kindness, all these things for yourself, right? As a human being yourself. And then you doing that for your kids, and then doing that for your kids, and they do it into the world. So there's really three levels of this that we want to practice in our homes. Because our kids need to see us doing it. I mean, the modeling it is the key.
Right.
Us telling them what to do, or telling them how to be active or how to be kind, and they're not seeing it and building the habit of it, it's all for nothing.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. They do, you know, it's do as I do, not as I say, right? Like that's what kids do. They just,
yes.
And it's so, I think that's the old paradigm of parenting. It's very much like, okay, kids, be good. But meanwhile, you know, you're doing other things that you perhaps don't want your kids to emulate. And then you're expecting them not to copy you.
Yes. Thank you so much for being here and talking with us. You. And we'll put your information and resources and everything in the show notes so that people can check it out. And you said your book comes out in October.
It comes out in October, but it's on pre-sale now. So if you wanted to purchase now, it's available. Then you get a surprise in October when you forgot you ordered it.
Yes. Yes. I love doing pre-orders for books for that very reason.
Yeah.
What's the best place to do that?
Good question.
Like, is it just Amazon?
I have a link. You can do Amazon if you want to support more local, smaller book companies. I have a link on the Instagram, Social Justice Parenting.
Okay.
And also on my website, which is also socialjusticeparenting.com. Oh, yes.
Yes. We'll put all that information, and pre-orders make a huge difference for books. That's a big deal for books. So everybody listening,
yes,
if you're interested.
Thank you for saying that.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. It's a big thing. So if you know that you're interested in this book, pre-order it. And then like she said, you get this like joy of one day it shows up in your mailbox and you're like, oh yeah, I already got this. So we'll put all
and
that
another
information
thing I'm doing
in the show
too, is people who pre-order, they're going on a mailing list, and I'm going to be doing some like Q&A sessions and some, you know, book talks with the people who pre-order.
Oh, wonderful.
Nice.
Good.
That's
to know.
Great.
That's amazing.
Perfect.
Yeah. Such good resources there. Your website is super helpful. So we'll make sure to add all of that for people to check out. So yeah. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, and thank you for the work that you guys are doing. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Oh,
thank you. We appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that so much coming from you.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to the Way We Parent podcast. If you enjoyed it, please leave a review on iTunes to help others find us. Share it with your friends and tag us on Instagram @TheWayWeParentPodcast. Let us know who you want to have on next or what topics you want us to cover. See you next time.